Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends.
So, some space updates. One is we're still waiting for the Artemis II launch. They had put Artemis II, this is the NASA mission to send astronauts on a trajectory around the moon, then back to Earth, which would be a prequel to the Artemis III. We're actually going to try to land astronauts on the moon. And for Artemis II, they're using the SLS, the rocket we made fun of a lot. And they brought it out for their wet rehearsal, which is basically they pump it full, the tank's full, everything else like that, and to see if everything holds. And lo and behold, they had a leak. There was a hydrogen leak. And so they had to go back and go in and look at it. And they found some more issues there. And, you know, it's the challenge with a thing that sort of sits there for years, you know, gets pushed out onto the stand, and then you got to pump it full and see what's going to work or what's not. They're optimistic they can fix this, but they're looking at probably, I think, no earlier than March 6th if they're going to actually try to be able to launch this thing. Meanwhile, NASA, but to his credit, the new NASA administrator, Jared Isaacman, has been extremely forthcoming, very forward about stuff. He's trying to be as transparent as possible because NASA's had a history of not doing that. And I think that's led to a distrust. One of the things that just came out is they just released a lot of their findings about the Boeing Starliner. If you remember, years ago, as we talked about it, before it happened, was there was this program from NASA to try to basically fund a private transportation to the International Space Station. And they had two winners of the contract. One was Boeing, one was SpaceX. Boeing was paid more money than SpaceX. But people, you know, had said, well, you know, Boeing's the, why are we even bothering to fund SpaceX? Because Boeing has been building spacecraft for years, and it just seems silly to actually fund SpaceX. I think Boeing had even suggested, why don't you just give us the SpaceX contract too, guys? We got this covered. Well, it turned out Boeing did not have it covered. And just because you have the same company name as people that built things that put people on the moon, et cetera, doesn't mean those people are actually working there now. Turns out, you know, you can just buy a name or inherit a name, whatever. And the Starliner had its first mission. It went up without a crew, and there were some serious issues with the thrusters, heat shields, et cetera, came back down. And they're like, no, we got this. We're going to figure this out. Then they sent astronauts back up to the space station on the Starliner. And they said, you know, it's perfectly safe to bring people down, but we're going to bring them down on a SpaceX craft, okay? And it was a big embarrassment for Boeing and the Starliner program, the fact that it was deemed, and NASA tried to spin it several ways too. Now we have this report that's come out that's talked about a series of things and went wrong. NASA did a number of things wrong, but part of it too is Boeing kind of exploited the fact that NASA wasn't providing as much oversight in certain areas, like, oh, we could get away with things. There were certain things that came to play, like little plastic Teflon plugs that were causing leaks that could have been addressed years before. But Boeing was just trying to cut corners left and right everywhere they could. And just literally isn't the first time they've had this kind of problem where they
try to say this seems very unlike the recent history of Boeing.
Yeah.
Everything that I've read seems to point to them being a real stickler for details.
Yeah. Putting the wrong sized engines on a plane and saying, we'll just figure it out later with a software update. So this has just shown more data, but a lot of it shows the problems inside NASA. Why they let it get away, they let Boeing get away with it, how NASA wasn't paying attention to these things, how NASA kind of carried water for this. So it wasn't just Boeing's fault too, it's NASA's fault. And that's the thing that Jared Isaacman's trying to do going forward is to prevent this from happening again. And, you know, there was a scenario where our only way into space was going to be on board Starliner, and a situation where the other way you get into space is Russia, who we are at a proxy war with. And it just, you know, there's an alt future there that's not as positive as the one we're in right now.
So I read a headline saying that they classified it a type A problem. Does that ring any bells? I could look that up. I didn't know if you knew what that was.
I don't know what that
is. Okay. All right. Mm. Well, here, while I ask a robot.
It's a certain kind of diabetes as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Certain kind of personality too.
Yeah.
We're now, and we've talked about this before, like Elon Musk, you know, for decades talking about Mars. Mars is cool. The moon sucks. Why would you want to go to the moon? The moon, there's no methanol on the moon, methane on the moon. Why would you go there? Moon is dumb. Now Elon's like, the moon is really cool. We should go to the moon. You know what? Let's go to the moon. We're not going to do the Mars thing this decade. Sorry, folks. We're going to go to the moon.
Remember, now, hold on a minute. Are you telling me a story in which Elon Musk has a loose relationship with the deadline? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, in fairness, he has delivered some miracles, and that's the thing. I get into this thing where I'll put a thing on Twitter and be critical of something, and then I'll get, you know, the Elon haters who try to convince me he's the dumbest guy in the world. I'm like, come on. He is a brilliant engineer. He's done some amazing things. He's also P.T. Barnum, too. P.T. Barnum put on a good show, got the elephants into the room, also showed us the Fiji mermaid, okay? Both are true. Both are true, you know? And I think that I would say the more divided he is across many different areas, the less confident I am in him delivering this. When it's just Elon, you know, going back and forth between Tesla and SpaceX, I'm like, cool. When it's Elon between like five different businesses, I would say that we've seen timelines slip a lot more.
Yeah.
But yeah. I also think that, you know, his Mars mission, which has really been at the core of SpaceX from its very, you know, beginning glimmers, it is a little bit different when you actually have a government priority to have a moon mission, and that SpaceX has become such a integral part of American space exploration and worldwide space exploration that you know, really fault him for shifting his gaze in that direction. Although I do think that he is prone to different flights of fancy. You know, that's where sometimes I think things do get undisciplined, is that he, you know, shifts his eyes to something else. And that's the most important thing in the world. And SpaceX, for as much as it's been probably the signature success of his career, because for whatever Tesla is in terms of, you know, being a brand new American car company, which was once thought to be an impossible task, let alone an electric one, SpaceX is, you know, a backbone of so much of what the future can be, that you know, it's very, very big. But it also hasn't been the new thing in a while. You know, he's obviously fixated on a lot of other things, chiefly right now AI.
And we've talked about before, like the whole space data center thing. Like I'm convinced we'll see. He'll put up thousands of satellites with GPUs doing data inference. Will it really be cost effective? I don't think so compared to Earth-based ones, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. I'm always going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think the pivot to the moon is interesting. And I'll tell you this, is that the moon, Mars offers, the upside of Mars was Mars has methane and methane is a fuel source. There's both the SpaceX rockets, Blue Origin, everything else that they've been building are all based upon methane. And methane, as far as we can tell, is in scant supply on the moon. Moon does have hydrogen, right? And that's going to be an interesting sort of rethink of what we're going to be doing as far as how we think about how we do things on the moon. But I think the moon is a great place to develop. I mean, moon, listen, I'm going to sell you on the moon, okay? The moon's got, we've talked about lava tubes and caverns. There may be caverns the size of Philadelphia on the moon, right? And yeah. We're used to the surface of the moon. We don't think anything about the subsurface, but the subsurface, they've had volcanic activity, et cetera, could be very interesting. The moon is also a great place if you want to do manufacturing. Elon's talked about the idea of putting, you know, basically a rail gun on there and being able to send material off the moon and into space and basically turning the moon into a manufacturing hub. If you want to do some really cool things like put a ton of solar panels on the moon, and we can start doing things like we've talked about before, like Project Starshot. That's where you start using humongous amounts of energy to send probes into solar systems near us at, you know, 30 to actually, you can go 70-80% the speed of light, depending on how much energy you can do. And this seemed kind of crazy a few years ago when we first talked about this. Now we're talking about data centers with 1 gigawatt of power. Project Starshot, you're talking about 10 gigawatts for like 10 minutes. So basically, whatever kind of facility, you could use a number of nuclear reactors then powering some sort of supercapacitor system. These things actually become realistic. It's crazy to think about this. I did a talk at Berkeley 2 days ago for a college group there and was talking about, there's a lot of things that 5 years ago sounded kind of absurd. Now are on the table.
Yeah. Oh, the age of miracles.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a big summit, a big AI summit. Well, just let me touch on this too. Part of, I think, why Elon's talking about the moon again is they have the human landing system, which is their part of Artemis 3. Right now, the plan is for Artemis 3 is for Artemis 3 is the Orion space capsule to go in orbit of the moon, where it then will connect with a SpaceX rocket, which will take it to the surface of the moon and then back up to there. And we talked about that, I think, on the last episode, but that's going to be a one of the reasons I think he's trying to pivot here now is that he's spread pretty thin and it needs to be pretty focused on, if he's going to talk about space beyond space data centers, the first body he needs to be serious about is the moon.
Do we have the sense, obviously, look, he is somebody who's got, one of the very good track record in terms of being an entrepreneur and running these companies. But like, it does seem like he's got more financial pressure on him now than he has probably in the last 10 years, maybe even going back to the origins of SpaceX, where he very, you know, publicly and transparently kind of wagered a lot of his own fortune and trying to see whether or not this was going to be a success. But, you know, Tesla's going through a period of transition. They're not talking about robo taxis for no reason, or these new autonomous vehicles for no reason. You know, SpaceX is coming up for an IPO, which is something that they said that they were going to be hesitant to do because they do need to, you know, raise money. Do you look at him and say, part of the reason why he's tightening his focus here is just because like this has to go well or else like things will be in a different situation?
Certainly Mars was the ambitious thing to talk about. Then AI happened and then that switched it. And I think I would say that part of why did he merge XAI with SpaceX? And I think that he was able to raise money for his last fundraise for XAI, but XAI has not been making money in comparatively anywhere near like way Anthropic or let alone OpenAI has been doing. It's not a player in that space. It doesn't have the API or the business users. It's not doing anywhere near as well. You know, the reports are maybe in the hundreds of millions, maybe $1 billion last year. I don't know. Versus OpenAI did north of $20 billion, right? And it doesn't look like XAI is on any great trajectory there. And so that's going to be a problem for him going down because he's got a ton of expenditures. He's been building these massive data centers, but he's not getting the same sort of usage the other labs are. So funding is a very critical thing. And that was why merging it with X and then merging with SpaceX created this very good narrative of like, oh yes, my space company, my AI company are going to merge and where the space company is going to be building data centers in space. Cool. But, you know, I would say cynically speaking, it just seemed like it really was a way to satisfy. How do I justify a really high, if he wants to raise $1.5 trillion in IPO and the combined revenue of SpaceX, XAI and, X is less than that of OpenAI. You need to have a narrative that tells people, no, the future's really bright. The future's really bright.
Yeah.
And the issue with Tesla is they're shutting down the Model S line and the Model X line. They're no longer going to make those. And Elon's going to say that we're going to shift those over to producing Optimus robots. Cool. We were looking at buying a Model X, you know, and then we found out, nope, going to be no more there. He's no longer the number one electric car manufacturer in the world, you know. I would say part of that was when you build your factory in China, remember China gave him a very special situation. Normally, if you put a factory in China, Chinese government wants to own it or own part of it. They told Elon, nope, free. We don't own anything. We just want to electrify. We want electric cars because, you know, we care so much about green energy. Ignore all the coal plants we're building on a massive level. And what happened was he built a Tesla factory there, and everything they needed to know about manufacturing electric cars was on display and went out the door and over to BYD and to all the other Chinese electric car companies. And you can see a rapid improvement in Chinese electric cars the day the Tesla factory came in there. And I think that doesn't get talked about a lot. I don't think he wants to admit the fact that he basically bootstrapped the Chinese electric car industry by giving them free reign of his factories to see how all of that was done. And so I'd say that the Tesla story is...
That's another shocking pattern of behavior. That's a crazy thing that certainly nobody has been saying has been happening since the 90s on a rapid, massive scale.
Yeah, I
usually you get extorted into partial ownership or full ownership and they steal your tech. So at least he got a better deal than that.
I love my Tesla. Absolutely love my Tesla. You know, my Tesla is.
That is one of the things where it's like it seems like he's in more of a squeeze than I have seen him in a while, because normally the things that he is starting are usually so blue sky, possibly profitable and nothing more than SpaceX, where you look at that and it's like, wow, you own the railway to the stars. This is gigantic. There's an entire economy that you could be the conduit to. That's amazing. And now it's like, all right, well, SpaceX is strong enough to hide the massive capital expenditures that you're going to need to make to keep up an AI, which is so big that it's like terrifying investors across the stock market. You need to figure out a way that you can play your part in that. And then, you know, Tesla's like, oh, we're into robots and autonomous vehicles now, where before, and look, part of this is also, it's going to be a lot more expensive to manufacture a Tesla because of, well, we'll see what happens with some of these tariffs after the decision today. But like, the tariffs affected them, the relationship with China affects them, and the rebate that now is just gone. Like, that also affects Tesla ownership. So it's like, he needs to figure out new things that he's making. And it's like, this is just a different kind of world than I think we're used to seeing. It's, you know, Elon normally plays in worlds that are like, hey, we're making good money now, but the future is insanely bright. And now it's like, oh, you're not the present caught up with you. Congratulations. You guessed right on the future, but now it's the present.
Yeah. It's
and going to be, unfortunately, he is not a part of the company that he co-founded that is currently the biggest on the, you know, the fastest rising on the planet.
Yeah. I would say that it would have had a different trajectory. I think that I'm excited about, you know, the moon stuff. You know, I just found out the Boring Company is going to be working on building a tunnel from between the Universal Parks.
Oh, smart, because they're pretty far away.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I think that, again, there's, I love the imagination. I love the excitement there. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. We have a big AI summit that's been going on in India. A famous video went around of
let's all hold hands.
Yeah.
Let's all hold hands.
Let's put Sam and Dario next to each other.
Did you see this, Brian?
No. I don't think I know all the characters in this story.
Okay, so this is the AI Impact Summit in India. Huge, huge, huge event. India is a massive market for artificial intelligence and for chatbots in general, because India's in general kind of a challenging market. It's huge. People want to be a part of it. It's got a very forward and Western leaning component to it, but it doesn't have the same kind of ability to spend money in the way that a lot of Western countries do. And AI kind of fits sort of perfectly into that, because it's a lower cost way that people who are very ambitious can interact with stuff. So there's this massive conference and everybody, all the players are there, up to and including Sam Altman of OpenAI and Dario Amodi of Anthropic, formerly of OpenAI, the same Anthropic that took out a Super Bowl ad trying to crap on OpenAI, putting ads in their free and go tiers. And so at the end, and this is something that I had to be read up on, that this is more of an Indian tradition, especially in moments of jubilant harmony and deal-making, that you everybody raises their hands together. That's more of a cultural tradition, especially with the Narendra Modi, the head of that country. That is a move that he likes to do quite a bit. And so he organizes this big moment where all the AI people are all going to lift their hands together. But oh boy, turns out Sam and Dario, not quite on a hand-holding level these days. And there is a we will lift hands, but we will not hold them. They will not be grasped.
Here's a headline that says, skin-crawlingly awkward video shows Sam Altman and Dario Amodei refusing to hold hands. Kind of want to see what's going on.
The question as to who, whether or not Dario reached for the hand and Sam was like, absolutely not.
As at no lies detected.
No, dude, you have no idea how pumped I am that we have a genuine tech feud back. Like, God, it's been so long since we've had like, you know, Steve Jobs threatening thermonuclear war against Google. Like, it's just, it's so much better when we have a good feud.
Yeah, that's the look right there, where Andrew, it's like they're both just looking right at the problem. Oh, there they are, our hands. Oh, is everybody? Everybody is.
I actually have the real photo, by the way. I'm going to show you the actual thing that this was came through, because what you guys were seeing there is fake news.
Oh.
OpenAI's account, the ChatGPT account, tweeted this out. The actually OpenAI's official account tweeted this ChatGPT.
that is Sam Altman with crab claws for folks who are only listening. This is an inside joke because it was ClaudeBot initially was a open source program that you could run natively on a PC that essentially is your all in constantly adjustable open source virtual agent that you could talk to with like WhatsApp and stuff like that. Then ClaudeBot, spelled ClaWed bot, got a nasty gram from Anthropic's lawyers saying you're not allowed to say Claude or use any references to Claude that makes it seem like you're part of Anthropic. So then they became Moltbot. Then they became OpenClaw. So open, you know, AI in,
oh, got
you know,
the it. So it's just like, well, hold on. Not everyone's in this Royal Rumble just yet. let me swing elbows over here.
Except that was a little bit more footsie under the table, because now if that developer works at OpenAI,
they have
now taken on OpenClaw as a under a foundation that will be managed. And that developer is now working with OpenAI on various different agents. So that is a scoreboard post from the ChatGPT app that we got this thing and you did not. You fumbled the bag.
Yeah. So there's...
And also crabs can't hold hands because they have claws. So that's why he didn't hold hands with them, because he has claws now.
Is it a crab or a lobster?
I don't know.
Do crabs molt?
Probably not. I don't know.
We'll find out later on.
Yeah.
Crab shape, one of the most popular shapes you'll find in nature, by the way. You know, it repeats itself a lot.
Crab shape?
Yeah, shape things that are shaped like crabs, yeah.
Outside of crabs, Justin, how many things are shaped like crabs can you name?
I guess bugs, right? There's probably a lot of bugs. I saw a thing at the very beginning of the second episode of Fallout last night that kind of looked a little bit scorpion crabby.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you go, you just say so flippantly, Brian, other than crabs, but they call it carcinization, which is the idea that these things take on these form factors. So there are a number of things that we call crabs. It is, look this up, Wikipedia, carcinization is a form of convergent evolution in which non-crab crustaceans evolve crab-like body plans. Mm. And so when you start looking at things, you hear like, oh, the coconut crab, not a crab.
Ah.
Looks like a crab. Many things that we say, oh, this is a crab. Actually, these things are more like lobsters or hermit crabs or other things. So it's a very, very popular shape. There's true crabs, the OG crabs. Then you get things like porcelain crabs, hairy stone crabs, king crabs, etc.
I read the word carcinization and I was like, oh, is that like cancer? Dot, dot, dot. You mean the constellation of the crab?
Yeah. So, yeah, yeah. There you go. There's a pattern that pops up a lot.
Yeah, I guess we also see the same thing. Like Australia is populated with a lot of marsupials that grew into the same shape as a lot of mammals because they didn't have mammals to take those evolutionary niches.
Yeah. You know, we've shown that before. One of my favorite images is the Tasmanian wolf, which is a marsupial. Like Tasmanian tiger, like a marsupial, like full on marsupial, meaning pouch, everything like this. A horse and a monkey are more closely related than like a marsupial wolf is to a domestic wolf or dog. But if you look at their skulls, they look extremely similar, incredibly similar. Yet, we are more closely related to a horse than that thing is to a dog.
Isn't that wild?
And, Yeah. Convergent evolution is fascinating. Meanwhile, at this AI summit, each of the heads of the AI labs gave different talks. Sam Altman gave a talk talking about how fast things are accelerating, saying we're hitting a very fast takeoff.
Bold take, Sam Altman. I guess somebody's been watching the Weird Things podcast from 3 years ago when we first invented that observation.
Well, it was bound to happen. It's been a very interesting sort of scenario.
Was there anything in those talks that stuck out to you or was this more of a presentation to kind of the world, which is generally catching up from people who are obsessed with this field?
Everybody, Sam and Dario are both telling people things are moving very fast. And that's because they're seeing signs of things internally. They're seeing that the models are improving at a faster rate than they did before. I can tell you that there are three factors at play here. One is these labs have been working a lot longer, have been able to do a lot more experiments, have a lot of really good ideas on how you can improve things. You know, when we started, 6 years ago, GPT-3, this was a model just chained on a bunch of random text and it did amazing things. And now we've gotten better methods. We've been able to think a lot more about how do you improve that? How do you train things more efficiently, et cetera? So one, just the body of work, the knowledge. We're over a half decade in now to understand how to train models better. Okay. That's thing number one. Number two is compute. This is the year, we've talked about this before, a lot more compute becomes online. And you saw ByteDance released their Seedance model, Seedance 2.0, great video model, really, really looks extremely capable model. I haven't tried to steer it, so I don't know how capable it is, but very capable model. Now we're in a situation where people are like, they're ahead of the American labs. Maybe, but it kind of comes down to priority. If you've got only X amount of compute, do you make a video model or do you make a code model? If you know the code model, it's going to make more revenue, right? Now with more compute, you get to do a lot more experiments, try different stuff. So compute's a big thing. Third factor is these tools. I've been talking about Codex, how amazing Codex is. It is literally amazing. I just give it tasks, I walk away, and it comes back, and it's built the apps, done the thing I want to do. And if I'm trying to train models or prepare data sets or do this sort of stuff, the tools that people are using inside these companies have improved dramatically. So I think those are the three big factors that are leading into it, aside from whatever sort of little secrets they've discovered.
Yeah. It's very instructive to see kind of just how fast everything is going. And also that all these companies keep hiring, which is interesting to me. Especially when we are looking at a lot of, projections and thoughts about what AI is going to do to the economy. It does seem like the people that are the closest to this technology are continuing to expand, largely because, they are constrained by their greatest bottleneck, which is just compute. Like they want to do a million different things and they are hiring people to do so many of them, but there's only so much that they can push in any one direction at any moment. And it's so funny to think of the Seedance argument because, Brian, if you could check this, are we even a year since VO3 launched?
VO3 was brand new around the time that I did the Papyrus essay, and you were really excited about it. And that would have been June of last year. So we're not even a year to VO3.
So we're not a year from VO3, where that was the first big jump forward of matching automatically sound and voice to the image. So it was a good jump forward in terms of what the images looked like, but also it was sound and voice. And since then, we're talking about less than a year, we've had, you know, the belt change hands, so to speak, twice. Sora 2 came out and had different kind of steerability, especially when it related to you being able to put yourself into a lot of these videos. And then, you know, you have Seed Dance, which I think there are questions of whether or not it will eventually be nuked from orbit on the internet. It'll be the dark web's favorite video generator because of copyright claims to it, because of what it was trained on. But there's no doubt that it looks phenomenal. What it's able to do and the way that it's able to put together sound and video is great. So like we are, the concept of somebody being ahead is different fundamentally than what it used to be. And it is a hallmark of AI technology, I think, writ large, which is that we normally think of improvements in terms of years, that there's a thing and then it's going to take years for it to be substantially better. And we've seen that in software. We've seen that in consumer products. Sometimes decades before there's a big change, and people are often afraid to change things or add new features because people get so used to it in that time. That's not the case anymore. Like the most used and explosive consumer product is ChatGPT. That's an unrecognizable product today than it was 2 years ago. You know, what has come from it and how we interact with it is entirely different with the Codex app and the Atlas browser. Like there was a bygone era that I would have said, oh, the ChatGPT app would have been my number one thing that I wanted to use on my computer. I haven't opened the ChatGPT app because I use it entirely in my browser. That's how I interact with the service now. Like these things are evolving on a level that we have never seen in the history of technology. And that's what's so exciting about it when you look at it from a consumer perspective, because it's always going to be different. The crazy thing is wrapping your head around the idea that, oh, this might be the slowest that it evolves.
Wow.
Pardon the background noise. If you hear, we scheduled a piano tuner at the same time as the podcast.
Classic. No, we weren't hearing anything.
My broken record, I really, really tell people try to use these tools. Download the Codex app. You're like, what do I need code for? Maybe you don't need code, but maybe you want to organize a folder. Maybe you want to try something else. There's a lot of really cool function there. Brian, the Windows version is coming soon, and it can be very useful. What's cool about it is that it's not just, hey, I can run this app and have it build a thing for me. It has automations. You can tell it, I need you to do this at a certain time. There's skills. I can tell it how to use different APIs to make videos or to make audio or to go to Levin Labs. I can literally just put a folder of transcripts and say, run these in a podcast. It'll just do it. It's just really, really kind of incredible where these tools are. It's worth the effort to wrap your head around it, because once you start figuring out how to just build things and do stuff, those skills can scale.
Yeah. So when Codex comes out for Windows, a project that I would like to do is do a full Google takeout of 20 plus years of emails and do a internal deep dive and find out who in all of my interactions through all the years has become interesting and notable in the last 20 years. And so right now, if you use any of the front-facing apps, you very quickly run into sort of jogging in place, and then it gets tired and it just tells you, you know, five people you emailed recently. And what I'd like is to actually have What I suspect I need to do is talk to Codex and have it write a script to parse, come up with a plan, have it strip everything out, parse it, and then set it to script and run individual searches on name by name and name. So I'm using local compute and it finds out and categorizes who's become interesting in what way to, and then, you know, suggest who I should reach out to and say hello.
Yeah, exactly. You basically, the problem with a lot of agentic solutions right now is they're capable of solving the problem if you put it in the right direction, but often their first case solution is you might tell an agentic model, I want you to generate 1,000-word vocab list for a foreign language I want to learn. And it might get to 100 words and then be like, yeah, I'm good, I'm done. But if you say, hey, I need you to write a script that calls an AI model and tells it to keep...
Whoops.
Add it and start calling an API.
Oh, there you go. You lagged out for a second, but you got back.
Yeah, I'll say that it can actually figure out, okay, how do I solve this thing? And there's a term called subagents, which is often what you needed to do is to create a subagent to do the task. And then the subagent might go through, will just keep going at it over and over again until it's done. If you just have the top level agent do it, it might run out of tokens or whatever, and just say, I don't want to keep doing it. But if you have it assigned subagents to it, they can keep going back and checking the progress on it. And that's been a big, big change.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be it's managing people has been a big skill. And then we talk about the idea of managing agents, but the idea is how do I manage a bunch of smaller systems to make sure the thing gets done? I've been putting together a whole thing about prompting, taking all my years of experience of that and trying to basically condense it into a searchable document that makes it easier to sort of explore that. And I would say that I looked at this and I was saying, like, what's the biggest shift I've seen in the last 6 years in prompting? And the difference is it used to be the very early days, you would start a pattern. Like if I wanted a blog post, I'd give it the first part of a blog post that I wrote and then let it finish the rest, was just letting it complete the pattern. Then with models like GPT, ChatGPT and the Instruct models, the ability was then just say, write a thing and you tell it what you want it to be. Now the prompting is really outcomes. This is how you know you succeeded. I want you to build a thing and I want you to look at the outcome, because then the model can create all sorts of tests and ways to see if it succeeded in that. And I think that's the way you have to think about that too. Like if you, for your project, Brian, you'd be like, oh, success would look like you were able to process, 500,000 emails, go through and sort the ones with the longest conversation threads and deliver me this sort of thing. Then the model's able to work backwards and say, oh yeah, I shouldn't just try to put this all in context and do this. I need to build a subagent or do that. But that's my tip, everybody. Think about outcomes. Tell the model the outcome you want, particularly because we now have these reasoning models, and outcomes work really well because a reasoning model lets the model take multiple attempts to try to solve a problem, takes a problem, breaks it down, tries to solve it, and then decides, did I solve it or not? When you give it the outcome, it makes it very easy to have a step to say, did I solve it?
And I guess to plus up on that, along the way, if you ever get a result you don't like, lately I just I do Shift Windows S and I take a picture of, usually there's the input, often a picture, my prompt, and then the resulting picture, and I just take a snapshot of that moment and I open a new thread somewhere else. I'm like, I'm not getting what I want out of this. What am I doing wrong? See how it looks dumb there at the end? And so then, even though it's the same robot, it's wearing a different hat, and it looks at it and is like, oh, robots be dumb like this, phrase it like this. And then oftentimes it writes the exact prompt and then I kind of copy it and paste it on over.
Excellent. Yeah, I think keeping track of all these things is super helpful. Yeah, I use screenshots a lot when trying to work on UI and that. Gentlemen, do we have picks?
I have a pick. It's an app that I discovered called Codex.
Really?
I'm playing around with Codex today, friends. So look, I would describe myself in the world of coding as an R word that only recently came back into favor. And
a roustabout.
Yeah, sure. Let's go with that.
Rapscallion.
there's just this beautiful moment we have where if you have dedicated time, I can go from one chatbot where I say, I'm very dumb. I need to use this thing and I need to understand it. When I open it up, I have basic questions that I'm sure are like day zero understood in the world of coding. Like, why do I need a folder? What's a repo?
What's the letter S for?
Yeah, like, and
where's the any key?
There's a snide element of people who are you know, in this world because this is their world. And, you know, usually it takes time and effort to understand the craft, but that's not the world we're living in anymore. We're living in a world where I can create a app that uses my camera on my iPhone to take a picture of something and then have it give me the calories, which was a app that was suggested to me by ChatGPT, because ChatGPT understood what kind of stuff I talked to it about, and therefore a thing that I would initially be interested in and would have the natural inclination to want to continue to tinker with it and work on stuff. So I've literally just spent this, you know, the morning going through the very basics of what coding, you know, is, or what development is, while working on this app and downloading all the programs that you need to do to make it, and understanding exactly how quickly I can go to a working prototype. Now, exactly how much this is going to be functional, how much I would use it, who knows? But I've had a tremendously fun time working on it, and it's gotten me from, you know, zero to 0.1 at the very least of downloading the apps that need to exist on a computer if you're going to do something like this. I gotta say, it's like, I would not consider myself in any way proficient in any of these things, but the ability to get to the level that I'm at right now as fast as I am while working with a technology that knows a lot about me and is, you know, meeting me where my knowledge level is incredibly important. So what I would say is download, if you're on Mac, download the Codex app, download or have ChatGPT or anywhere else that you normally talk to. Although I would recommend ChatGPT as far as the memories and how much, if you use that as your primary thing, then it already knows a fair amount about you. But I had it suggest a thing I should do, a project that I should make in Codex. And every time I had a problem, every time I hit a roadblock, I would either tell it what it was, I would copy what the error message was, or I would take a screen grab and put it in there. And lo and behold, each and every moment, it would push me through what would otherwise be a moment where I would quit and keep me on the path. And that's the biggest thing in terms of knowledge, is just finding the moments where you would allow yourself to be distracted by something else, and therefore derailing a thing that you would do. And now there's zero cost to asking dumb questions. And I don't know if that's ever been the case before in life, let alone having it be able to interact with tools that are that powerful and therefore give you the wind in your hair of like, ooh, look at me. Like, you know, I was at a coffee place, and I go to an app that is on my phone. Like, it sucks. It doesn't do anything, but it worked. You know, it was an app that opened up my camera and took a picture. Like, the formatting blew and it gave me fake calories, but like, it was there. And that was the one shot. That was the first thing. And then from there I could say, hey, I wanted to do X, Y, and Z. And I wanted to look generally like these kinds of things, and then boom, 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 all that changes. It really is a crazy world.
Yeah, man, I can't wait to play with Codex.
I mean, yeah, there are tools. I mean, you can use, you know, the Codex model.
I saw the documentary Eddie Murphy Raw. Technically, I can get a hamburger, but it's not a McDonald's hamburger.
I mean, it's coming very soon, Brian.
Yeah, but you're saying like it gives you dumb answers too. God, man, but you want to know what's so much better than just not knowing anything and hitting a blank wall and having no idea what to do going forward is a dumb answer. Like, and especially when you've got multiple different ways to say, hey, this seems dumb, is it? And then you can look at the code and be like, yep, it's dumb. Like the moment that I was working with between Codex and ChatGPT, ChatGPT is like, hey, let me know what Codex is doing. Just give me the code of what Codex says it did for you. And then it was like, yeah. And the check. By the way, this is not a real model for recognizing things. What you're going to need to do is X, Y, Z, and you need this API key and you need to go through this, that, and the other. And so it's like, it's walking me through where it's pointing out the flaws. Do I have a finished product? No, unfortunately I had to leave and do other things before I was able to load up the final version, but I'm on the road and I'm excited to go back and check on it, which I think is the biggest reason what I wanted to do today.
OpenAI has announced that they have a version for enterprise. They may be testing other things. Codex may become a brand for different ways to just get stuff done, agentic stuff. I put a book into a folder and I said, can you go through and edit this book and create a new version? Did it, you know? Just a lot of non-code stuff is extremely possible there. Image stuff, things like this, you can give it access to your desktop. I'm excited about this because as a person trying to manage a lot of different things, it's now at the point where it's more competent than I am. So
exciting.
Brian, you have a pick?
What did I just, my pick is the book Decoded by, let me get the name of the author. It's a marketing book, but it's about really about brain science. If you liked alchemy, as a matter of fact, Rory Sutherland wrote the introduction to Decoded. It's great. Let me see if I can find. There we go. Phil P. Barden. It reads a little bit like a user's manual for humans. And it talks about, you know, everything from choice paralysis to nudges, endowment effect and all this stuff. And it just goes through really, really fast with specific examples of specific experiments and how much more you get from one thing or the other. That's a really, really good one.
Cool. I've got a meh and then a pick. I watched the 1976 King Kong, the Dino De Laurentiis one.
Oh my God. Wait, is that the one that Stephen Pressfield worked on? No, it was, I'll find it. Sorry, keep going.
That's the one with Jeff Bridges, Jessica Lange. I dig it. You know, the effects, you know, it's 1976. You know, there's a guy in suits to some weird mechanical things, but I dug the story, enjoyed it, really liked it. I just thought it was a very timely thing too. You know, oil explorers go to an island trying to find oil, instead find a giant ape, say, okay, we'll make that the mascot of our oil company. You know, yeah. Really, I dug the hell out of it. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go watch, let me go watch the Peter Jackson King Kong.
Mm.
When's the last time anybody watched that?
I mean, in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I saw it in the 'twas theater, beauty saw that it, slayed the beast.
I saw it projected. Hoboken used to do like a summer movie, like they'd like project it on a big outdoor screen. So I watched it against the skyline of New York City. That was pretty cool. But also in both of those instances, both in the theater and then, I'm like, boy, this is a long first act. Oh, they're on the island. This is a fun second act. Look at all this fun action. And then, boy, this is a long third act. Good God, this is a really long third act.
Yeah, I've been watching the extended cut, and you're like, oh, he wanted to make a horror movie.
Yeah.
You know, he just wanted to make a horror movie, not an adventure movie. And it's literally scary scenario after another. And it's just literally like, it's like an Eli Roth does King Kong, in my opinion. Like literally, And then the spiders try to eat you. And then the swamp creatures try to eat you. Then the dinosaurs try to eat you. And then you try to get a stampede. And I'm Peter Jackson. I think the Lord of the Rings trilogy is amazing, like fantastic. And like, I will let him make an infinite number of meh movies that if he wants to, because we have that. Characters were not engaging. This VFX is terrible. You're just watching people running under stampedes. You're like, this is not, I'm watching people in front of blue screen. You know, like this is just not, every now and then if a limb comes in front of you, I don't believe they're here. You know, I thought the CGI was bad, really, really bad. He did this color grading to it to give it this weird sort of look. We just made it look even more like Sky Captain of the World of Tomorrow. You know, and it's just, I think Adrian Brody can be a great actor in this role. You're like, you don't care. You know, like, I just like, man, I don't care about anybody. It's well crafted to an extent, but man, I'm not. And King Kong is terrible. Like, you know, when she goes to his lair, there are all these dead bodies of all the other women. He's murdered them. Like, yeah, we need to kill him. We need a public execution in New York City of somehow to basically punish this terrible, terrible creature. I was like, man, I'm still working my through it. And now I got to get to the New York City scene and he's got to be the sympathetic character. I'm like, I'm sorry. I saw the dead bodies, Kong. You know, like this is your crawl space. It's filled with dead
women. Watching a toddler with a handgun, but I'm not enjoying this.
But you're old, you know, you should be, you know, this. And it's just like, he is a monster. And I don't know if Peter Jackson realized, like, no, you made a monster here. And then they're going to bring the monster to New York and hopefully they will kill the monster. And you're not going to be sad that the monster's dead because it was murdering people on this island. So I think he may have lost sight of that. Like, I'm like, well, somebody kill this ape already. Anyhow, that was my like, yeah, man, this is rough. My pick right now, haven't finished the last two episodes, could go off a cliff, but man, Wonder Man.
It doesn't.
Wonder Man. I loved Wonder Man. I don't think that you're going to be disappointed in the final two episodes. We've talked about it a little bit. Let me just reiterate what I love the most about Wonder Man. Especially in a world where we've seen a lot of Hollywood satire, you know, there's a lot of that's been out there, and it's often really, really funny. The one thing that I like the most about it is that, like, there is an earnestness to it, and whenever you do these kind of Hollywood stories, the moral is usually this is a vacuous, soul-sucking industry that will crush your dreams and probably your life. And that's true. So it rings true. But the thing that I like the most about Wonder Man is that, like, they really do care about acting. And it is from, yes, actors are silly people and oftentimes they're vain and there's an element to it, but they do care, and it does care earnestly about that craft. And I really came away liking that the most, especially seeing it in the world of not only just a Marvel movie or a Marvel story, but also just a Hollywood satire story, because usually it tends to be a little bit more cynical. And I really enjoyed the heart of Wonder Man when it came to that.
Yeah, it would have been very easy to just turn Trevor Slattery into a caricature, which I kind of think they did in Shang-Chi. But here they show, like, yeah, he is a great actor. He loves the craft of acting. And there's scenes, you know, he Simon, and you think that Trevor's motivations are another matter. But, like, as an actor, he's like, he genuinely wants to help him out. Like, there's an audition scene. You think he's going to sabotage. He's like, no, because he's like, the acting is too sacred to him. He wouldn't sabotage another actor because that would be, you know, an insult to the craft. And there's, you know, the Joey Pantalone, you know, scenes. There's just some great cameos from real actors who are willing to go in there and be jerks or doofuses and stuff. So I'm enjoying it. Yeah, looking forward to the next two episodes. I think the casting was great. The dynamic between the two is great. You know, it shows what Marvel can do. Interesting stories set in the universe.
That feel different. That feel very different, that you have the ability in this wide, you know, palette to tell different stories. And that's, you know, even the Joe Pantoliano character, the thing I like about it is that, like, he's got motivations. Like he, we understand kind of where everybody's coming from, and like you can be thin-skinned and self-centered, but you don't have to be a monster. You don't have to be a total cartoon character. And that's, it's great. Like that character, I really liked how Trevor Slattery tells the story that we see at the beginning. And then Joe Pantoliano kind of tells his version of their origin story together. And it's like, oh yeah, this feeds into some of these other themes to the larger character I won't spoil it for people, but it's good. It's rich. And that's what's super fun about it.
Yeah. And I'll say two things. Did you ever watch Agatha?
I did. Yeah.
I did not.
I like that.
I enjoyed it. Yeah. I enjoyed that. I think that there's been some of Marvel writing has been some of the stuff, some of the reasons they were motivated to do some stuff, I think were silly, but some of the stuff was good. I enjoyed Agatha. I thought that was fine. She-Hulk, other than the last episode, and I could think of, there are silly things in there, but I thought like, yeah, there's been some good Marvel TV, I think when they try to do the really big stories, they've sort of sucked.
Yeah. Well, luckily they're not getting ready for the biggest story of them all.
I'm sorry. You both spoke.
So are we. I said, luckily they're not gearing up for the biggest story of them all, getting ready with the whole Avengers Doomsday with every single character all at once.
Yeah. I mean, that for the movie, that's fine. I mean, for the TV show, I guess the TV shows, it's been like Secret Invasion was terrible. Falcon and Winter Soldier was just, and you're like literally that bad, and also like we want to make a nuanced villain. Like these are just villains.
These are just terrible people. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, I mean to go back to Agatha All Along, what I liked, I really kind of clicked with Agatha All Along as soon as I realized like, oh, this is kind of a series of haunted house stories. Like that's what each of these episodes are. It's going to be kind of like a haunted house procedural where each scene or each episode, we're going to go to a different haunted house and they got to figure out a way out of the haunted house. And it's going to teach us a lesson. It's going to reveal something about each character. Cool. I'm locked into that. I understand where you're going. You're not just going to give me mystery box after mystery box and need the actors to kind of carry it. There's an unfolding mystery that we have a general sense about. At the very beginning, there was a satisfying end to it. And then you can rely on great performances by really good and funny actors throughout the process. And that was like, Wonder Man has its own flavor to it, but it's also kind of a story that's contained. And I think that's what they've kind of hit on with the TV is that when you're like, oh, let's tell a movie script like Falcon and Winter Soldier or Secret Invasion, it fails. It collapses on itself because it's too big and poorly done. And there's other reasons why those things sucked. Where it's like, hey, here's a story. It's got the following people in it. And then we're going to go forward. It tends to do well. And I'm happy about that.
Did you guys see the trailers for Spider-Noir?
Yeah. Looks awesome.
We'll see. I don't know. I like Nicolas Cage very much as the voice of a cartoon character called Spider-Noir. I am attempting to keep an open mind about him as a literal playing Spider-Man.
I will say, looking at that trailer, I feel like I have a pretty good trailer sense of like what they're showing us. The one thing you know about that trailer is like they really care about the look of that genre. This is not a show where they're doing, it's just it's a regular action adventure script that they're just going to shoot. They're going to colorize in black and white and call it a day. Like this looks and feels like a different kind of thing, which I'm excited to see. I'm pumped to give it a try.
I just missed it. What are we talking about?
Spider-Noir.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah, I'm going to look up who's doing that, because like I watched the black and white and the color version of the trailer. I like the fact that they're like, you know, we're going to do this in black and white just in case.
Yeah.
They did the same thing for what was the, I really liked it. The Marvel, what was the Marvel Wolfman thing or man?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Werewolf by morning or dawn or
werewolf
something.
By night. Yeah. Werewolf yeah.
by night. That's it. Yeah.
Did you, if you didn't see that,
I love that.
Yeah. I enjoyed it really well. That was, directed by, Michael Giacchino, the composer.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool that he got a chance to do that. I thought that I really liked that kind of story. I want Marvel to do more of those kinds of stories, but again, they did it in black and white and they lose to color one because that's often off-putting to people. But I like those things. I think that sometimes doing those smaller kind of things can actually be pretty cool. So I'm looking to see who is who's doing Spider-Man Noir. You know, interesting. You know, producers working on 22 Jump Street. Lost City. Are Lord and Miller producers on that? Yeah, Lord and Miller are producers on that.
On Spider Noir?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because it's from the Spider-Man.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. You know what? If they still have a hand in it, then I will upgrade. The forecast is looking sunnier. Or
we're going spider. I'm willing to upgrade to two brushwoods.
That's right.
It was initially at a half brush.
I was originally one thumb sideways. Now I'm two thumbs sideways. Yeah, ready to see.
The director of the first one's Harry Bradbeer. He worked on Fleabag and Enola Holmes.
Enola Holmes was cute.
Yeah, I'm of the opinion that the quality, the talent is there. There are sometimes I will go, the talent is not there, and I will just check out of stuff. I think that's been a problem with a lot of the Star Wars stuff. I go, these seem like really nice people.
Oh my God. There was a thing. So there, by the way, shout out to the brand new episode from the Modern Rogue teaching you the solitaire card game Scoundrel.
Shout out to Andrew Main. Who put it on our radar.
Oh, yeah, put it on the radar. But there is a moment where we're joking about Flea, because there's a Flea mechanic in F-L-E-E. Brian and I keep joking about F-L-E-A, the bassist from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I was trying to remember what Star Wars he was in. And I guessed three different Star Wars things. And I didn't get any of them. I'm like, oh, it was Mandalorian. Oh, it was Boba Fett. It wasn't either of them. It was Obi-Wan. It was Obi-Wan. But they all look the stupid same.
There's a story that's going around. Steven Soderbergh had the storyline that they went really far in development, which was going to be the hunt for Ben Solo, the idea that maybe he survived after the ends of
Rise of Skywalker.
Rise of Skywalker. Which fine. I don't care. If you have a great story, you're in the genre universe, just go do it. And Soderbergh can be very interesting.
Yeah.
And eventually he got killed. And they said the reason was that execs had trouble understanding, you know, how he could. I don't believe that. I think they just killed it for some other reason. And I look at this and I go, like, man, you know, Soderbergh writing a really cool, interesting story that's post that era. You know, an actor, I think, Adam Driver, can be very interesting. Actors, kind of cool. And then you look at like Obi-Wan, and you're like, oh, we're going to give you the chapter of Obi-Wan and Darth Vader, you know, between Episode 3 and Episode 4. And I'm like, oh my God, this should be Godfather 2. This should be amazing. And instead, we get, you know, the most annoying version of Princess Leia ever, and all this weird. You know, we're going to invent new canon. Fine. It's not going to be good new canon.
No,
you know,
you're not going to be. Yeah. Obi-Wan's going to work at a fish factory.
It's hard because when you actually look at the budgets and you find out there was money, but between the machine of Disney and ILM and Lucasfilm and everything else, and how many execs on set, how many people, I've been in this too. I've seen this in reality where you're on set and you don't have a lot of money to spend with, but then you go off to go do something adjacent to this and you see millions of dollars being spent on your production in some other way. And you're like, Jesus. And like, that's part of it. And it comes down to is they don't want to pay for talent, whatever, but like, holy cow. Anyhow, Mandalorian and Grogu, everybody, come this May.
Yeah, I saw the trailer of that. I liked the Super Bowl one better, where they were just making fun of a Budweiser commercial
that nobody remembered.
Yeah.
We're going to do member berries that nobody has anymore.
The Clydesdales.
Let's hope Starfighter's good, everybody.
Let's hope.
Yeah.
A new hope.
And let's hope
take
we get
this script. It's a good Star Wars movie.
Yeah, new Star Trek. Let's bring in some new talent now.
Oh, by the way, have either of you watched Night of the Seven Kingdoms? It's getting like crazy buzz. People really liked it.
We watched the first, so I think we'll try to continue. We just finished Fallout, by the way. Fallout's loved it. Loved Fallout. And now we're going to go to 97 Kingdoms. I want to continue there. I watched the House of Dragons trailer. I don't remember anything. What's going on? Kind of don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, gentlemen.
That one lost me.
It's been weird.